Live from the Talking Joe Studios, it's Talking Joe.
G.I. Joe, the very best, America's elite. Eliter than all the rest, trained to have no flaws. Defending liberty across the land, valor oversized. Bring out that big brass band, real heroes verified.
G.I. Joe!
Gotta read them all, you must agree. Elitist in history,
G.I. Joe.
Oh, there could be no end in a world we must defend.
G.I. Joe,
gotta read them. A courageous crew, their colors red, whites, and blue. Mess with them and they'll shoot you. G.I. Joe, gotta read them all. Gotta read them all.
Hey, 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 it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe, the best and longest running dedicated G.I. Joe comics podcast. If you're new to the show, you can find out all of the details over at our website, which is talkingjoe.co.uk. Today, we are continuing our look at the Disavowed era with G.I. Joe America's Elite, issues 9 through till 12. Which were published by Devil's Due, March 2006 to June 2006. They were collected in 2006 edition of America's Elite Trade Paperback 2, called Ties That Bind, which collects 6 through 12, or the 2013 Trade Paperback from IDW, America's Elite Volume 2, which collects 7 through 12. So I will not be talking about these issues by myself, as much as I'm sure you want that. You don't. I will be joined by my regular co-host. It's a real American Tim. It's Tim Finn.
Hello, Mark, and hello, listeners.
Hey, Tim. It's been a little bit of time since we've spoken, you and me, even if the listeners don't realize that, because these things keep on coming out despite when they've been recorded. So that's good. I've had a holiday. I've been to Munich, and you've been to conventions and things.
I've been to two G.I. Joe conventions this summer, and I have written about one of them on my blog, and I will immediately begin writing about the other.
Excellent. So head on over to A Real American Book to find out what Tim's experiences of Joe Fest and Joe Lanta were. And will you be heading to Codename Iowa Assembly Required this year as well, Tim?
Yes.
I see that all of the details are now on the website, so you can get all of the stuff, buy the tickets. They look like they've got some interesting things. This year they've got some Dreadnought grape soda for their Dreadnought theme.
Last year it was I was surprised by how small the show was.
Oh, really?
But it was also my first toy convention since before the pandemic. And what I realized is that calling it a small show is a negative, because it's a great show. There's a lot of great stuff to look at, people to talk to, things to do. And so it's a snug show. It's a compact show.
Intimate show.
Yes.
An intimate and friendly show. I do keep on thinking to myself, when will I get over to the States, and will I ever go to one of these shows? And if so, which one shall I pick? And it does, you know, it could next year be the year? Could I go to Joe Fest next year Assembly Required next year? Maybe, I'm not sure. I've got, in the UK, we have got Rollout Roll Call coming up in November. So that is even more intimate than intimate. It's like a small town hall, but it's the only G.I. Joe show that we've got in the UK, dedicated one. So, you know, it's It's the top one. And I also went just recently to NICE convention. That was what I was doing last weekend while we didn't record, Tim. So that is sort of essentially north of London. And it's, again, quite an intimate convention. It's very focused on comics, comic creators and comic art. So it primarily it is a set of tables with comic artists tabling at and people, you know, buying their art, getting commissions and con sketches and that kind of thing, with nary a Funko Pop stand in sight. So that's one of the highlights of the convention season for me. And I think the last one for that might have been 2018, and so it's the first proper convention that I've been to since COVID times. I think I've been to MCM, but I wouldn't necessarily classify that as a proper comics convention, because it's more geared to large scale entertainment rather than a lot of comics. And I did get a couple of things for my G.I. Joe sketchbook.
Mm.
So I got a Jacob Phillips sketch, son of Sean Phillips, doing some books for Image.
Oh yeah, he draws
that Texas Blood.
Yes. Ugh. What's that book that starts with an M? N. Newbery. He draws Newbery.
The other one I picked up was a Barry Kitson Baroness.
Oh, neat.
Watercolors. So
did Kitson, is he one of those guys who did a little Action Force before in
the
UK? Okay.
No, he somehow snuck between the cracks. He sort of was a bit ahead of the curve and made it over to the US before Marvel UK was making it as big.
And he also did not draw any of the UK Transformers.
Yeah. So he didn't. He was one of these creators where I said, you know, do you know G.I. Joe? And basically, nope. So, but I'll give it a go. So he drew Baroness for me because it was a safe choice, because I know that he's drawn that character before for commissions. So I felt like it was a safer bet. Right, so convention talk aside, we will be talking today about G.I. Joe America's Elite issues 9 through 12. The people that brought these comics to us were Joe Casey, who was on script duties for the Mel, and on pencils we had a bit of a mixture. We had Nelson Blake II on 9 through 11, Pat Quinn with assists on 11, Juan Barranco and Josh Meadows on 12. Josh Meadows, I think, picking up duties as the regular pencils a little bit down the road. Inks were John Lowe, 9 through 10, Dan Davis and Mark Englert on 11, Vincente Cifuentes and LeBeau Underwood on 12, and equally colorists were a mixed bag. Imaginary Friends Studio, which was Art Germ, Stanley Art Germ Liao's studio, Danielle Rodoni, Jason Jensen, and Greg Navarra's. Letters were Brian J. Crowley. Military advisory was from Phil Cost, and it was all edited by Mike O'Sullivan. A lot of people there. That's a convention in itself if you have those people all along. We've got 4 issues and 5 covers. Should we have a quick run through of them?
Yeah.
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
So 9 and 10 are Stefano Caselli, and 9 very much looks like him. You can see it in the faces. I like the cover to 9. The cover to 9 has this phenomenon, which I don't like. Every so often, artists draw characters holding machine guns or lasers, and they're shooting forward, and the muzzle flash is so big, it sort of covers all of the weapon and all of the hand. And it sort of ends up looking like the character isn't holding a weapon. They're just like blasting from their hand. And that sort of happens doubly here because the muzzle flash is sort of lower than it should be. It actually does line up as if Major Blood is blasting from his fists, whereas the flash should sort of be higher than his fists. Mm. But it's a cool image. It's a cool drawing otherwise.
Yeah, so this is mostly Major Blood shooting with Storm Shadow, Scarlet, and Roadblock behind cover. It's a bit of a trope, really, on G.I. Joe covers.
They're in the foreground behind some debris, and he's in the middle ground with fire behind him, and he's all yellowish, and he's shooting straight at us, straight at them.
Yeah. Based on the comments that Sam Wells was saying about Hasbro asking that weapons aren't shown on covers, potentially the muzzle flashes and the absence of guns on show could have been a way of getting around the Hasbro mandate that they're not showing a gun, they're just showing flashes.
That's true. Scarlet is holding a pistol.
Mm-hmm.
Number 10,
see the end of the muzzle.
Number 10 has no guns, although it does allude to all of the torture that Duke suffers in the issue and in the next issue. 10 doesn't quite work for me because the logo covers up Duke's ankles sort of as a compositional element. Like, from context, I understand what's happening, but in terms of composition, I sort of don't know what's happening. It's like, well, he's hanging, but I sort of don't know why or how. And I sort of don't understand, not sort of, I don't understand the like assembly, the construction of these chains and whatever like a weight is or a counterweight. It's like, I get it. He's hanging, they're trees, the sun's out, he's sweating, his hands are bound. I understand it. Actually, it's sort of like how Major Blood's muzzle flash seems to line up with his fists. Like there's a compositional thing about the cover that doesn't work. It is a nice contrast to the previous cover because the cover to 9 is loud and the cover to 10 is quiet, right? He's not yelling, he's not screaming, he's not growling, he's not lunging, he's just hanging.
Hanging out with some grim determination.
The cover A to 11 is Tim Seeley and an Udon, and Seeley signs it Seeley 05, just visiting, which is cute. I think this cover is pencils only. You can see a little bit of sort of broken line in her shoulder blades, in the wrist, the two wrists of the red ninjas in the foreground, and there's not a lot of heft to any of the lines. All the lines are sort of like dark gray. I think this is like sort of under-inked and over-colored. Like, I think the, you know, highlight on Scarlet's hair and her wrist and her throwing star works. But like, I don't understand what this like light source is on the back of the Red Ninja's shoulder and head just above the like barcode corner box. I think it's a good idea for a cover. I think it doesn't really come together for me. But to describe it, it is Scarlet in sort of coiled attack pose, holding a throwing star and a sword, fighting five or six red ninja in a sort of interior, like stone, rock, you know, temple, mountainous space.
My speculation on this one is that potentially, combined with the knowledge that Tim Seeley will sort of help out at last minute, the fact that he's, you know, on staff and available, and that comment just visiting makes me think that maybe there was a cover gap and they, you know, asked Tim Seeley to help out at potentially slightly late notice. That would be my speculation.
Yes. You can see how these four issues, and the letters page even refers to the dreaded deadline doom. These four issues, Devil's Due is running behind schedule. You know, whether it's Joe Casey, whether it's the artists, whether it's approvals from Hasbro, and the fact that Stefano Caselli has left the book but hangs around to do covers, but then doesn't do all the covers in this, I guess you'd call it an arc, and then Seeley shows up to do a cover and isn't contributing to the book otherwise. Yes, absolutely. Cover B, the retailer incentive for issue 11, is a Stefano Caselli and Danielle Rudoni And it is, we're looking down at Snake Eyes, who is sort of backlit. His front is all in shadow. There is a cast shadow of vertical bars, as if like he and the 1, 2, 3, 4 Joes who are unconscious around him on the ground are all in a jail cell. But there's also a like a vertical ceiling support, like a gray column. And notably, Snake Eyes really pops from the blue-gray floor background color because he is in red. And we have only seen this, I think, twice. This sort of Snake Eyes is all in black, but instead of like coloring all of the costume parts that aren't actual black, instead of coloring them gray or very, very dark blue, which is the convention, here he's colored red. And the only other time we've seen this is in the middle of Rob Liefeld's Snake Eyes Dead Game miniseries, where it happens for no reason. And it's a cool visual that I actually don't like. It's too much the opposite. It's in the same way that I don't ever want to see Storm Shadow in all black. You know, if they do like Night Force Storm Shadow, I want to see him in like middle gray, you know? It's like you're sort of breaking the character's, my expectations of the character's like visual convention. And I get it. It's like, no, he's evil. He's Snake Eyes has been turned evil here. And it certainly makes sense because of what's happening with other characters in the story who are in red. But as a visual, I sort of like squint and think, no, it's wrong. And then lastly, for the cover to 12, Phil Noto shows up. And at this point in, you know, 2005, 2006, Phil Noto is known for only a couple of things, like Beautiful Killer and some Danger Girl. And we'll talk about this when we read the Scarlet Declassified special. But this cover this comes from some place. This isn't arbitrary. But when Phil Noto does covers, he's often composing characters looking straight on at you. And so you have this montage here of Scarlet standing at the ready, Storm Shadow, Kamakura at the ready, and then behind them is Snake Eyes, head and shoulders, and behind, much, much, much larger, and then behind that is, I can't tell, some letters or numbers in a military stencil font, and a map. And Noto is not just coloring, not just drawing, but also coloring, and he's a very, very good color artist, digital painter, right? When he draws comics, he's not just penciling, he's also inking, and he can color and paint his own work. And there is a real orange cast to this cover, which you can really see if you look at the highlights on Kamakura's left side. If you look at Storm Shadow, who is not, he's not showing up as white, he's showing up as orange. And then just above the bottom corner box with the UPC barcode, it says 6 extra pages, which I like. I think when you have a longer book, you should hype it. And it's not any more expensive than normal, but 6 extra pages is not so much to actually get me excited. Like, if a comic's going to be oversized or double-sized, it needs to be double-sized. I need this, you know, 24-page comic to be, you know, 36 pages or 48 pages. And so now and then in the Devil's Due era, it's like 4 extra pages, like 6 extra pages, you know, like 1 extra page, like, you know, okay, thanks. Like, you know, what else do you have for me? I very much like this cover, even though there's no story to it. It's just cool. It's just a good drawing. And this is one way that you draw Scarlet or a female character in G.I. Joe as sexy and attractive, but without it being exploitive or stupid, right? She's not like bending over and sticking out her butt or anything, right? She's just drawn like very, very like handsomely, very alluringly, but she's still a capable soldier with, you know, determination and weapons.
And yeah, I think, there's only a handful of covers that he does. I think it's this one in issue 14. And I'll just call out for the record that this is one of my favourite Devil's Due covers from Phil Noto. Yeah, very striking, very well done, and that, as you say, they're sort of the way that he often draws eyes. It's sort of looking directly at the audience, and so it's sort of like making quite a kind of strong connection between an image and the reader, because of the way that he draws those eyes in such a striking manner, looking directly at us. Good stuff. So let's get into talking about what happens on the inside of the issue. It's been a few weeks, so just to summarize where we left off, it was with Snake Eyes dead and his body missing, while Duke was captured by some bats in the Amazon. So, here we go.
Plot breakdown.
The Joes begin a worldwide scavenger hunt for Snake Eyes' missing body. In Australia, Storm Shadow fights Major Blood, who reveals he has recently killed a Joe. The Red Ninja Clan, having stolen Snake Eyes' body, have begun a secret ceremony to revive him. Snake Eyes' micro-homing device activates, and the Joes follow the signal to Mongolia. Just as they arrive, their helicopter is shot down, and they are attacked by the Red Ninja Clan, led by Chabang and aided by the mystically resurrected Snake Eyes, who is dressed in a red costume. It is discovered that Chabang has had his essence switched with the comatose evil Red Ninja, Satin. The Red Ninja Clan turns against Satan when they find this out, and Storm Shadow is able to redeem Snake Eyes by allowing him to stab him for some reason. In the secondary plot, in the Amazon, Duke has been captured by a former Fred series Crimson Guardsman, Colonel Calvin. Duke is able to escape and defeats Crimson Guardsman Calvin. He stops a missile launch which was destined for Cobra Commander, targeted at his location in Washington. We close on the bombshell that Cobra Commander is working as the president's chief of staff under the name Garrett Friedlow.
Okay, in terms of reminding ourselves where we are, we have seen the president previously in the first 8 issues before we get to these 4 issues we're talking about. He's in issue 1. He shows up once or twice since then. Do you remember, Mark, have we also seen Garrett Friedlow? Or is that name?
Good question. I think this is the first appearance from this guy.
Okay.
But certainly we've seen a bit of the president, and the president has been coming across as a little bit anti-G.I. Joe. You know, in this arc, he's not allowing them to, officially go on their mission to try and, investigate Snake Eyes' homing device. Seemingly he is a little bit anti-Joe, and possibly it could be this Friedlow whispering poison in his ear. But we shall doubtless find out a little more in the future.
Do you have an overall reaction, or you want to start with something good that's working? Where do you want to start?
Overall, it's going along at pace. I read these 4 issues and I thought to myself, "Oof, are we biting off more than we can chew trying to cover off these 4 issues in one go?" But we can do it, Tim. I'm sure we're up to the task. but there's sort of quite a lot going on, sort of as the Joes, go around the whole world on sort of various missions. And I guess there's a sort of fairly grand story happening here, which they do conclude, relatively quickly. So, I think it's an interesting storyline, and they sort of move along at pace. It's executed relatively well, but there's some elements that I'm less of a fan of, and we'll get to those in a bit. What about you, Tim?
Yeah, I think overall there's good action, there's a good variety of ninja stuff, mystical ninja stuff, regular non-ninja action, like helicopters and punching. There's a little bit of the brass, you know, Colton talking to his superiors and, you know, talking to Sparks. There is checking in with a Cobra character who we've never met before. I mean, this Crimson Guards person, but they still represent, you know, a portion of Cobra that we know and like. There's no update on the Dreadnoks, Destro, Baroness, any random, you know, unique vehicle driver like
Motor Viper,
Copperhead. Yes. Okay. Major Blood does show up. He does something. He says something incendiary. I like what's going on with Colonel Calvin, Colonel Crimson Calvin. Even if I feel like Casey doesn't get the most drama out of it. I feel like it might be, I don't want to say too one note. I think that's a little insulting. That's a little reductive. I think Casey sort of gets like 80% of the way there with the subplot, where, you know, in previous issues, Duke has a lead and then he goes into the jungle and he's captured. And there are these bats, these like old worn out 1986 version one bats with like torn clothing and slightly missing arms. And then they spend part of an issue and part of another issue torturing Duke. And then he escapes and punches Colonel Crimson Calvin and stops the launch. And I feel like one more thing needed to happen. Similarly, the ninja stuff, I think if you told me this as a plot, if you read the comics and said, oh, there are a couple issues of G.I. Joe where the Joes go to the Red Ninja and Snake Eyes died and his body is missing, and they get there and he's back, but he's evil, and he's wearing red, I'd say, oh, cool. And then it turns out that Chabang and Satin swapped bodies, and that's why Chabang is evil. I think I'd say, oh, these things are all great. And when I actually read it, doesn't quite work for me. And I don't know that I have a good explanation other than to say, and you and I were talking about this in our previous episode on this run, I think there's something about G.I. Joe that isn't a great fit for Joe Casey. I think Joe Casey's take on ninja stuff, on military stuff, I don't quite have the words for it. It might be a little too casual. It might be about the pacing, like, you know, maybe a Chuck Dixon, a Mike Costa, a Fred Van Lente, a Larry Hama would find a way to cram in more. I know in a previous episode, there was a moment where someone did something, and I said, if this was a Larry Hama scene, there'd be three added word balloons where someone's explaining sort of exactly how this works. It's like, this is how you hotwire this car, or this is how you like defuse a grenade, or like, and whereas in this Joe Casey moment, someone just like does it. They just like throw the sword and then like cut the line, and now they hotwire the car or whatever.
Yeah.
And similarly with the Major Blood thing, I feel like Major Blood shows up and there sort of isn't a lot of like the promise of his appearance isn't quite fulfilled. And the letters page refers to this, actually. The letters page in, I think it's 10 or 11. They're like, yes, we were called to task. Some letters pointed out that Major Blood didn't do a lot when he showed up.
Yeah, and to the cover to 9, where Roadblock, Scarlet, and Storm Shadow are under fire from Major Blood is not delivered on in the interiors. I wonder if the cover maybe was commissioned before they knew exactly what the plot point was going to be. It would just be like, it's the Joes against Major Blood. We don't know the specifics, so just draw something cool.
Based on how covers are drawn in the last 10 years and, you know, how they need to be done early so they can be in catalogs. Yes, very likely. But also you're allowed to.
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
well, we know Major Blood's going to be fighting Storm Shadow. Why don't we have Major Blood fighting Storm Shadow on a cover? Like, oh, should I throw in two more Joes? Yeah.
Yeah. Why not? It doesn't have to be exact. That's fine. And that's allowed within comics. Yeah. Major Blood is a great character, and you don't get within the pages of G.I. Joe, you generally don't get to see enough of him. So as you say, it's almost like a bit of a promise unfulfilled that we see, that we don't see so much of Major Blood as maybe we would all like. Let's touch on maybe the Major Blood scenes a little bit. So he's sort of, he's in Sydney to assassinate the Vice President of the United States. And Tim, in your copy there on whatever page that is, like page 5 or so of the comic, where the Vice President is in the sights of Major Blood's sniper rifle, is that a guy with hair or is he bald in your copy?
He has hair and it's brown.
Yeah, so there's a curious thing that actually happens with this, which is that in, I believe it's, what happened was that it, in the trade paperback, he is shown as being bald and looking very much like Dick Cheney, who was the actual vice president of the United States. So I sort of reading between the lines and putting the pieces together, what I think probably happened was that he was originally drawn to look like Dick Cheney. It was, you know, reviewed possibly by Hasbro and reverted back of, you know, you can't be using real life representations of people like that, make him look different. And then I suspect when they went to print the trade paperback, they might have reverted to an earlier version of the files and have that that issue slip through. So there's, yeah, and it's this interesting curiosity that depending on which version or which copy you're looking at, you might see a slightly different vice president.
3 years earlier, in the pages of DC Wildstorm's The Authority, in some issues written by Mark Millar, possibly written by Grant Morrison. He did some ghostwriting for Millar at the time. The president shows up, and Arthur Adams, who was drawing these two issues of The Authority, drew George Bush the Younger. And someone higher up at DC said, absolutely not, because The Authority was already sort of a controversial book, because you've got this Superman analog and this Batman analog, and they are a couple, and the book is like tearing down a lot of superhero conventions, and the Authority are the villains because they take over the world. So Arthur Adams redrew this president to just look like sort of a regular guy, like a bald guy with like brown hair on the sides of his head, which the manager of my shop reminded me is actually the president from Dr. Strangelove. So while I'm upset that the image for original publication was, I don't know if censored is quite the right word here, let's say corrected or softened, it becomes a different reference. Anyway, so comics even then recently had a little tradition of backing away from putting real political figures in the crosshairs.
So there is then a sort of confrontation between Blood and Storm Shadow on the top of the Sydney Opera House. There's an interesting bit where Blood points out something that we probably all noticed, which is that Storm Shadow is still carrying a Cobra sword. As Sam Wells points out, that's something that Hasbro asked if they could do, because there was this actual, you know, prop sword that was being sold by a licensee, and so there's a sort of plot reason to explain why he's still got it, a reminder of the life I've left behind,
which really stuck out to me when I read that. I feel like that's Joe Casey making the best of getting stuck with something. Like, no, he wouldn't be using this sword.
There's quite a cool moment where they're sort of fighting and tussling and they're sort of falling away from each other, and Storm Shadow uses his sword to dig into the roof to stop himself from sliding away, and Major Blood also uses his hand to grab onto the roof to stop himself from sliding away, and which is a kind of reminder that in this continuity he has lost his hand and now has a cybernetic hand with enhanced strength, which means that he's able to you know, grab onto the side of a structure as he's sliding away from it.
And yet Storm Shadow seemingly blows up that hand with his little 50-cent piece silver dollar sized explosive.
Yeah, it was that was a bit of a moment where I was like, I'm not entirely sure what exactly is going on here, because some of this, you know, the him getting this explosive, it's not necessarily a device that we recognize as being something that Storm Shadow would normally use. It's being attached to his hand in a sort of a extreme close up with relatively murky colors. And then the you know, the explosion itself is colored in such a way where it's not exactly clear what's going on. So, but yeah, sort of putting all the pieces together, Storm Shadow has put this explosive on his hand. It blows up, sending him shooting away from the explosion and landing in the Sydney harbor.
Falling into the water at a very strange angle.
Yeah, because they're meant to be fighting on the top of the Opera House, and then it's sort of the trajectory is kind of up to the anyway. What's left of it.
I also had a hard time. The two panels where Storm Shadow pulls out the explosive, sticks it on Blood's hand, and then a panel or two after the actual explosion, I had to read this three times and inspect it to figure out what was going on. And some of it is the, quote, camera angles, and a lot of it is the color, yeah.
And the way that he's sort of flying down into the water and splashing, it's sort of colored to look like it's Cannonball from X-Men sort of, you know, blasting his way down into the water. And it's like, is that the way that if you had an explosive device put in your hand and you're on the top of a building and that goes off and you are thrown away, you know, into the water, is that the way the physics of it would work? I'm not really sure, but okay.
Also, it's this explosive is powerful enough to, I think the implication is, remove this hand from Blood, right? Which is poetic, but Storm Shadow is right there, and I don't see so much in Storm Shadow's. Well, I guess he is running away. Okay, it is explained, but I feel like the explosion is big enough, Storm Shadow is close enough, that Storm Shadow is at risk for hurting himself. But yes, it is visually depicted that he's sort of bounding away as the explosion happens. In the letters page of 11, Tim Dowell writes, "The return of Major Blood was somewhat of a letdown. He barely made a handful of pages." And then he says other things. "The Joes are just as concerned about Blood's comment as you are, Tim, and they are definitely looking into it. Was it blustery hyperbole or an actual reality? As for his brief appearance, we've been called to task for the short page count of Blood in number 9.
And the last panel is also a bit weird. It's Storm Shadow stood on the top of the Sydney Opera House, pointing at a massive platform boot?
Storm Shadow's index finger and middle finger are extended as a visual reminder that it was that hand that retrieved and planted the bomb a few panels earlier. The thing down there is Blood's helmet.
Oh.
And right. Blood is not wearing his helmet two panels earlier when the explosion hits.
Right. Okay.
So again, a lot of cool stuff is happening on this page between layout, drawing, composition, color. A lot is being asked of this page. And Blood's new helmet is not so iconic that when you draw it and you color it kind of dark, everyone is immediately going to know what it is. You know, this isn't like Storm Shadow's Cobra sword, you know, which like has an insignia on it and is a very particular shape. Major Blood's helmet doesn't look like any helmet we've ever seen before because it very coolly incorporates his eye patch. But also it's sort of like, what?
I don't think I would have ever worked that one out on my own. There's also an interesting plot point that is introduced here where Major Blood teases that he has killed one of the G.I. Joe reservists as well. And this is something that's sort of followed up in subsequent issues and mentioned by Coulton, where he's sort of talking to Sparks, where he's trying to check in to find out who it is that's missing. And we will get to talk about that when we cover Special Missions Tokyo, Tim, which will be the next episode after this, I think.
All right, so listeners, in these four issues, 9, 10, 11, 12, Blood mentions he's killed the Joe in 9 and in, I forget, another issue in these four. Yes, Colton and Sparks are trying to figure out who it is. These four issues do not reveal who it is. And a question for Joe Casey might be, did you know who it would be? Did you think you would do something about that? Were you inventing it and leaving it vague for other writers to pick up? Did you, you know, want to try and do something with it? You ran out of time, or they said no.
Or it could even be that editor Mike O'Sullivan said, "We've got this idea. Can you sort of plant a seed in this issue?"
Yeah, because I'm going to do a story in Special Missions Tokyo.
Maybe.
All right. So my overall comment for 9 and also for 10, I like Nelson Blake II's art. It's very clean and all of his lines are very thin. And it reminds me of Sean Chen, who drew Iron Man after Heroes Reborn in the late 90s, when for a year the four Marvel books go to Jim Lee's people and Rob Liefeld's people, and then Jim Lee's people. Sean Chen drew Iron Man when I think it's Kurt Busiek and Sean Chen take over Iron Man, and it starts over as a new number one in like 2000 or 2001. This is when George Perez is drawing Avengers. This is when and Chen's art has always struck me as sort of reliable, but a little thin. His lines are very clean and a little thin. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is that in 2001, Sean Chen was drawing Wolverine. This is in the like 170s, the 180s, and was penciling Wolverine. And for the first year, his anchor was Norm Rapmond, who I think had been discovered by Extreme Studios a few years earlier, like inking for Rob Liefeld. And then he also inked like Dan Jurgens at DC. And Norm Rapmond's inking on Sean Chan's art on Wolverine around 2002 was fine. And the editor, I think this is Axel Alonso, but I can't remember, thought that it lacked a little heft. And after a year, hired Tom Palmer to ink Sean Chen on Wolverine, because Palmer inks with some thicker lines. And I don't actually know if he's inking with a brush or a pen or both. But when I think of Tom Palmer, I think of heavier inking on like John Buscema on Avengers in the mid 80s. And it did bring a little more heft to Sean Chen's pencils on Wolverine. And when I look at these Nelson Blake II pencils on America's Elite 9 and 10, I'm thinking, I sure wish there was an inker who would ink with some thicker lines and more variety of thick and thin lines.
Mm.
And then my other comment is that issue 9, overall, not just the scene with Blood and Storm Shadow fighting and a little bomb, the coloring overall is too dark.
A little bit muddy.
Yes. I think it looks good on a monitor, on a computer monitor. But, you know, by the time we get to the scenes with the Crimson Guard's person and Duke and these bats in this factory in South America, it's just very, very dark. And I can tell what's going on, but it's printing too dark. It's like sort of not fun to look at, and it takes a little bit of work.
Yeah, my main observation about the art is that essentially it's fine, that it looks fine. It looks all right. The storytelling is generally clear. It's generally, you know, clear who the various characters, but it's somewhat functional, less exciting. And because I've got my issues all bound in a, you know, single volume, they're all sort of next to each other. And as sort of flicking between the issues, between issue 0, 1, 2, and, you know, up to where we are 9 through 12, the comparison against Stefano Caselli's earlier art, particularly that issue zero, it's not so flattering. It's a high benchmark that we started this America's Elite run at, and I think in terms of where we are against that initial benchmark, it's not
he's not drawing poor anatomy. He's not penciling ugly or poorly composed panels. He's not choosing weak or undramatic quote camera angles. But there's some real pep to a lot of his sort of fight poses. But in terms of his actual visual style, there's a little less heft, there's less pep, there's less flavor or spice. And I don't want to say boring, because that's a mean word, but Stefano Caselli's style is a little more animated, a little more vivid. And this is part of where I'm coming in with, like, you know, I want a different inker and I want a different color approach.
And we maybe talk about the Colonel Calvin, the Crimson Guard arc as a sweep across these four issues as the kind of the B plots.
Mark, does this remind you of an episode of G.I. Joe from 1986?
Doesn't. Does it remind you of an episode of G.I. Joe from 1986?
It does. It does. Ladies and gentlemen, please pull out your Rhino or Shout Factory, preferably Shout Factory, because they fixed the mistakes. G.I. Joe DVDs, or head on over to Hasbro's YouTube channel. There's a great season 2 episode of G.I. Joe. Season 2 is the one that starts in September of 86. And it's an episode called Raise the Flag, which is kind of a sequel episode to another episode without being a direct part two. And in it, some Joes and Cobras go underwater to raise the flag, because the flag went down when one of those giant Cobra airships crashed into it in a previous episode, and they both sink. And when the Joes get there, this crazy Cobra chef named B.A. Lacar, who's got like Coke bottle glasses, and he hasn't shaved. He's got a big bushy beard, and he's wearing a blue Cobra soldier uniform, but no gloves, just his bare hands, no boots, and a chef's apron. And he has survived down there using Cobra bats to, you know, like do cooking and cleaning, basically. It's just him and his Cobra bats, and he's a little nutty. And Zorana says, pretty sharp for a fruitcake. And his bats have like torn sleeves. They're not like missing pieces and like chunks out of their forearms. And they don't suddenly have weird, like, stabby knives and forks at the ends of their arms instead of hands. But this is one of those fun cases where I think two people writing G.I. Joe for different media and in different eras had a slightly similar idea. And it's fun to make the comparison. I don't think in any way Joe Casey like saw this episode and forgot about it and ripped it off. Absolutely not. But you have this disgruntled Cobra guy, and the difference is, if I'm remembering Raise the Flag correctly, B.A. Lacard isn't going to launch missiles. He just wants to stay there. He just doesn't want anyone, like, well, now that you've come here, you have to stay. So very different. How do you feel about the Crimson Guardsman plot?
It's quite interesting. I like the fact that we're sort of getting an individual Crimson Guardsman and sort of building out a character, which is something that happened in the Hammer run. I'm thinking, you know, particularly of Wade Collins and his predecessor, and like Professor Apple as well. That and over in the Marvel UK run, they did have a number of sort of stories where the Crimson Guardsmen were sort of created. There were Crimson Guardsmen centric stories where they sort of were investigating their kind of, you know, deep undercover and sort of, you know, rounding them out as sort of individuals. So yeah, it's a fertile ground to sort of delve into, you know, all of these deep cover Crimson Guardsmen who potentially have been sort of put to one side, forgotten about as Cobra has gone through its various incarnations. I'm not necessarily completely behind the whole story, but I'll get behind it. So he's sort of gone a bit nuts. He's got the bats, and for some reason he's decided to turn against Cobra Commander, and he wants to set a missile strike against him, and he's able to somehow trace exactly where he is, but doesn't want to know where he is. And then, yeah, he's sort of doing that thing of monologuing to his captive without necessarily, you know, too much of a game plan about what he wants to do with him. And then inevitably his captive escapes and turns the tables on him.
I feel like there's a reveal near the end of issue 12 where Duke escapes, comes to the control center. They fight. Calvin almost pushes the launch button, and Duke looks at the computer, and the computer says launch procedure aborted. And then he's typing, and it says accessing target coordinates, and it sort of zooms in on the White House, like an overhead view of, you know, downtown Washington D.C. And in red letters, it says, target, United States, Washington, D.C. And Duke says, Washington? And then you turn the page, and there's more ninja fighting. And then you turn the page, and you get this wrap-up where the president sends three people out to talk to his advisor, and that's actually Cobra Commander. So sort of cynically, I thought, oh, was Joe Casey... Is this a way for Joe Casey to lead into issue 13, which the ads in 9, 10, 11, 12, there's a one page or two page house ad in each of these issues, continuing some from some previous issues, which is like teasing the return of Cobra Commander, that something big is going to happen with its giant red and white number 13. And that is certainly a way to look ahead to your next issue, to your next story. That's certainly a way to tie your current story, your B plot, to your next, I think, A story. And I think it's quite clever to have, you know, the missiles going somewhere. Duke figures out where it is. It's DC. You turn the page. Cobra Commander's in DC. You get this reveal. And yet still, I feel like I don't know quite enough about this Crimson Guardsman. I don't know quite enough about sort of why Duke had to go off on his own to get him. On the one hand, I'm glad that sort of Duke and him fighting after Duke frees himself and takes out the bats doesn't go on any longer, and Duke just sort of aborts the missiles. But sort of like the end of... was it that fight at the end of... Was it issue 4 where the Joes are... shooting, I forget what it was. The Joes are at their base outside, and Flint's like, "You want a piece of me?" And they're like, "Whoa!" And the Joes take out all the. I forget what it was. It was something Cobra flying something at the Joes.
It was all of the satellite stuff.
Okay, I feel like sort of here's another Joe Casey resolution, which sort of 80% of the way there, like. On the stakes as defined are clear and heightened, but I'm not sort of satisfied in the actual like moving of chess pieces and the sort of emotional component of like, oh, we almost lost it all, or like, oh, so-and-so's gone over the edge, or like, he got away. Like it's not, you know, it's like, okay, this G.I. Joe soup that Joe Casey has made, it's like, all right, needs salt. And some of this is that his artistic collaborators are changing. There's a lot of change. You know, there's a bunch of artists in these first 12 issues. And some of this may be the learning curve. You know, you like, you get asked to do this licensed book, and there, you know, it's like, you're going to, you know, what's your take? You're going to get to do what you want to do. And then a few issues in, you're actually having your monthly back and forth with your editor and then Hasbro. And maybe there are some things that you have to do a little differently, or, you know, maybe you come in with the intentions of, you know, small team. And then even with a small team, it's like, man, there's a lot of characters here. And I do think it sort of can't be forgotten that whether or not you like Larry Hama's G.I. Joe stories, Larry Hama was both in the military and also spends a lot of time, present tense, Tim, making sure that stuff is accurate. Like how a piece of equipment is used. You know, it's like, no, you have to hold this gun with two hands because it's that heavy. Or no, this gun, when you feed this kind of ammo belt into it, it's like every fifth bullet has to be a different color because it's a different kind of bullet, right? Anyway, so Joe Casey has by this point, you know, written for TV animation and superhero comics and some interesting superhero comics that go a lot further than standard superhero comics. And G.I. Joe has sci-fi, it has superhero, it has mystical elements in it. But the actual sort of moving of pieces and character and equipment, you know, he writes differently and he has different concerns. And so the stories come out differently. And so my sort of overall reading these four issues, it's like, I don't want to say like, I don't think I like Joe Casey as a G.I. Joe writer. I don't think I like Joe Casey's G.I. Joe stories. I don't know that I'm there yet, but there is something in them that's missing. And I caught something in issue 9. Actually, it's on the first page. It's on the first page of the four comics that we're reading for this episode. Scarlet is so angry. She's so upset about their inability to track Snake Eyes that she punches a computer screen in a base, in a naval base in Japan. And Scarlet and Snake Eyes' relationship is so strong and they're so loyal to each other. And, you know, you exaggerate things in comics for effect. You know, you don't have someone just pointing. You have them like lunging and sneering and pointing. But still, she's like, she's not Flint. You know, she's not like angry about Lady J and vengeful. Like, no, that's expensive. Like, you're a soldier. Don't break that. So that on the first page and the second page, that sort of jumps out as a, like I don't want to go back to this well, but like Larry Hama wouldn't do that.
And there's a second moment in this four issue arc where something very similar happens because Kamakura gets angry at being told that they can't go and investigate Snake Eyes' tracker. And then I think takes a sword and slices a piece of machinery or a monitor in half as well.
Yeah. And then while we're making a list, in issue 11, in issue 11 on page 6, a sword cuts through Roadblock's heavy machine gun, like cuts it in half. And it's like, sorry, these ain't lightsabers. And also, or Wolverine's claws. And also, like, Wolverine's claws and lightsabers can't cut through things in an instant. You know, like, it's still like a heavy thing. There's still friction, you know? It's like, I appreciate it in any Star Wars movie or show when it takes them like a minute to cut a hole in a door, you know, because it's like, yeah, I understand the analogy of a hot knife through butter. But like, you know, Wolverine has metal claws. Metal against metal is still, you know, it's not like they're not laser claws. And then another thing happens while I'm doing this list of sort of less realistic or less ground, maybe the word is grounded, less grounded things that are happening in Joe Casey, G.I. Joe comics. In issue 10 on page 5, Roadblock headbutts a Crimson Guardsman? And
through his helmet.
And his helmet shatters. And again, it's like Scarlet on the first page of this arc. That's a really cool visual, but you know, like, this is a helmet that's meant to like stop exploding shrapnel from injuring a Crimson Guardsman, and Roadblock is really strong, but And, you know, we've seen Roblox in the animated show and the movie, like, take two cobras and, like, bash their heads together and they're, like, unconscious. But, like, no, you can't break a helmet by headbutting it. You know, maybe if it was already, like, partly shattered, but, like, that's not established. And so I see what I think is the sort of more superhero influence or the less realistic military reality of equipment and, you know, how people act in the chain of command.
One of the things that I read, which where I sort of did that mental Tim component of saying Larry Hammer wouldn't write it like this, was when Scarlet it mentions a couple of times that she's not able to sleep, and in issue 11 there's a moment where she says, I know I haven't slept in more than 72 hours, but this is real. That signal is real. And I thought to myself, if Larry Hammer was writing that, he would probably write something like, you know, be more along in lines of, you know, I don't want to go to sleep. And Snake Eyes is, you know, the thoughts of Snake Eyes and is running through my mind. But I'm a soldier. And I know that when you're a soldier, you just have to get your sleep where you can. And it'll be them sort of just trying to you know, they're on the jets flying over to the next mission, and they're just trying to grab a couple of, you know, minutes here and there to top up their reserves so that they're ready for when they need it. That kind of thing.
Yes, that is a good observation. And I'm not trying to say, like, Joe Casey writes bad comics or Joe Casey writes bad G.I. Joe comics. He's not Larry Hama. I'm making the comparison because while I'm reading this and I'm thinking, okay, this is different. And I just want an explanation for myself of how it is different. And so I think, okay, well, what would the other guy do with this scene? It's like, okay, so now I can sort of see what the difference, I understand the shape of it. And then it happens another time. There's another sort of unrealistic, silly thing. In issue 10, there are, on page 6, there are three Cobra soldiers who are firing on Flint, sort of from one end of the hallway, and they're not that far from each other. And Flint, you see them firing, and then you see sort of in a reverse angle, Flint firing back. And none of them hit him, and he also doesn't, like, try and take cover. And I need a little something else happening in the scene where they're like, you know, oh, our machine guns, sights got... the alignment on our scopes are messed up. I can't aim properly. Or Flint isn't just sort of digging in to fire back at them, but he's sort of lunging behind a rock, or I guess he's inside, behind a wall or a door or something.
Maybe the subtext is that he's
angry and crazy.
Yeah, reckless.
Yeah.
Reckless, okay. But still with a good aim.
yeah, I think you could still ground it a little bit more. Do you remember how he got this scar?
It's not completely consistent. It's there most of the time, but I think
because it's the way that it's sort of a left right line from like one cheek halfway under his eye, over his nose to halfway under his next eye on his cheek, and I was looking at it and I thought. Well, that's like someone's tracing his face like a sword did that. But I don't know. I'm thinking too hard.
Yeah, it's not completely clear because he does have a sort of an inconsistent kind of some scratches on his face at the very end of the Devil's Due run, but I guess not consistent enough for me to think that it's intentional. So I'm guessing it's meant to happen between the end of 43 and beginning of maybe let's while we're talking about Flint and his corridor bullet dodging, maybe we talk about the Joes taking down the Cobra cells. There's sort of two small components of this arc where the Joes take down two Cobra cells as they're sort of searching for Snake Eyes and or information about Snake Eyes' missing body, and it made me think that, hold on, you're meant to be G.I. Joe, your main mission is meant to be taking down Cobra,
but you're only going and taking down these cells because you now want to find what's happened to Snake Eyes. Why didn't you do it before? You know, it didn't make a huge amount of sense to me.
I will admit I slightly lost the thread of sort of the urgency of which mission the Joes looking for Cobra cells or looking for Snake Eyes. But I take your point that something's a little, the priorities might be a little bit wonky here.
Oh, and actually we do see a little bit of Tomax at the very beginning of issue 10. He's on a call to the Cobra cell in Vancouver, Canada.
That's true.
Who talks about plans are in motion. The organization is gearing up for a new dawn.
I think he's talking about 13.
He might be. Our greatest campaign ever. We've been patient and soon our moment will arrive.
Part of why I like to read issues, back issues, and less graphic novel collections. I mean, you know, sometimes a graphic novel collection has some great bonus features or an introduction by someone who's there at the time or some smart person who's reflecting back on it. And that's a great feeling too. But when I'm reading these issues, I'm seeing all the ads and I'm so struck by, you know, here we are into the early and middle part of 2006, right? We're a little past 5 years into Devil's Due on G.I. Joe. And there's the G.I. Joe Declassified miniseries gets advertised in here. And the Scarlet Declassified one-shot gets advertised here. And the, is it the third Devil's Due G.I. Joe Transformers, The Art of War miniseries gets advertised here. And
A teaser for issue 13.
Yeah, which progresses over each issue. The ads get sort of bigger and bolder.
Snake Eyes Declassified trade paperback.
And
And the special missions as well. Pretty sure in there somewhere.
And this Josh Blaylock like contest, and the Sigma Six comic, you know, which is running at the time, and the 10th or the 10-year anniversary for the official G.I. Joe collector convention in New Orleans. So there's all this sort of added excitement. And that even, you know, if the issue itself sort of reads too fast, or I'm thinking, well, I don't know about Joe Casey, or well, I don't know about Nelson Blake II, sort of all the added frills elevate the experience. You know, it's like, no, it's back in 2006, and Devil's Due is really making a go of it with G.I. Joe, and there's all this other stuff, you know. And when I just read a trade paperback, and I'm reading like a concentrated 22 pages, and then I turn the page and I just read the next issue. Sure, the book feels nice. It looks great on my shelf, but it is a different experience.
Mm. Yeah, there's no doubt. Sort of looking at these issues, that Devil's Due are doing a lot with the G.I. Joe brand in terms of the variety of comics that they're putting out at this particular point in their journey. Right. So I think in terms of the plot points that we've covered, the remaining one is the big one. It's the Snake Eyes story set in Mongolia. And my feeling towards it is a little bit echoing what Major Blood says in issue 9, which is, I always hated that ninja crap.
Ninja Bolt. It's all the time, G.I. Joe and Ninja Bolt.
So one of my arcing issues with this is that, you know, the ninja stuff just often is just a shortcut of it's like a Jedi power, and I like it to be a little bit more grounded than that. It shouldn't be a sort of a plot get out of jail card to just do any old thing that maybe you'd could get away with that mumbo jumbo in a superhero book, but less so in a G.I. Joe book. A little bit, a light touch with it, a little bit now and again, that doesn't sort of stretch incredulity too much is my preferred approach to all of that. And there was the death of Snake Eyes and his return and redemption by the end of issue 12. And, you know, even if I didn't have any memory of reading it, which for the most part, I don't have a huge amount of memory of reading this in the original incarnation. I don't think I was ever in any doubt that that when Snake Eyes died in that submarine, that he would be dead for very long. And similarly, as he was brought back as a sort of a bat inverted commas baddie red ninja, I didn't have much doubt that that also wouldn't be for too long. It was only really for the best part of two issues.
Yeah, the last. Last 10 or 15 years of DC comics have felt to me gimmicky, and some of the gimmicks are great. I don't mean cover gimmicks. I mean story gimmicks, like the big cosmic multiverse crossover event stuff. And I think it's interesting when Batman is on the JLA Watchtower, or when he's on the moon, or when he's fighting like an evil Batman from another, you know, dimension. At the same time, that stuff is sort of bigger than Batman should be. And I really want Batman stories to take place in Gotham City. You know, I want him to investigate crime and take down, you know, muggers and, you know, very occasionally go outside of Gotham City. I sort of think of the scope of the 1992 Batman the Animated Series. You know, it's like, all right, well, the three-parter when he meets Superman, that's awesome. Those are actually three episodes of Superman. And with G.I. Joe, it's like, no, Snake Eyes is already cool enough. And Snake Eyes is so cool. You don't have to do a lot with him. You can sort of just like, it's almost like a pullback toy, like a little car. Like, it's enough to pull it back and let it go. And I don't need that car to also like have wings and like flip upside down. or like change color in cold water, you know, or like shoot sparks. So I think having Cobra Commander infiltrate the White House is really interesting. And like, I'm on board. I'm ready to see where it goes. And I think having, you know, the Joes having problems with Colton, or Colton having problems higher up, it's like, that's interesting. We've seen some of that before. That's a thing that the G.I. Joe might have to deal with. But I think killing Snake Eyes, like, no, I don't buy that. And the sort of thrill or shock you get for it isn't enough, because it's definitely not going to last. And to have him become a bad guy, and it's mystical, and it's like Red Ninja mystical with also someone else sort of swapping bodies, like trading their minds or their essences, on top of, you know, Storm Shadow has come back, you know, Storm Shadow's done his third good guy, bad guy switch, mm-hmm. or second, I don't know. It's like, no, it's, you could just have Chabang go bad.
Yeah.
Or you could just have had Satin lock up Chabang and return the Red Ninja to evil. And like, It's sort of too many things, and it's stretching it too far. It's like, no, I just want Snake Eyes in Gotham City, taking down criminals and like answering the bat signal, talking to Gordon on the top of the, you know, police headquarters.
It's like stacking the cards, just too many on top of each other. You know, you could maybe in an isolation, you could have Storm Shadow thwipping away bullets with his sword like he was a Jedi knocking away lasers. In isolation, you could have Snake Eyes being revived using, you know, ninja powers. In isolation, maybe you could have him going bad, although, you know, it feels like it's been done. And in isolation, maybe you could have Satan coming back, but, you know, having that switcheroo, maybe even that's a step too much just on its own. And then you could have Snake Eyes redeemed with some Arashikage mindset ninja bullshit. You know, he has to stab me to be turned around, which I feel like has been done before, you know, as well. He was, you know, just missed the vital organs, so he can't have been too deep into the trance. But yeah, all of those things all together certainly feels too much on the shit scale for me.
And to make the Larry Hama comparison, I feel like if some similar things were happening with the Red Ninja, you know, they've been taken over, someone's turned evil, I feel like it would have something to do with a past secret, a past quest for revenge. I think there would be some redemption in it. Someone would be forgiven. You know, like, I think about issue 250 a lot, G.I. Joe 250. It's like, wait, you're forgiving Firefly? I'm so angry at him. and he's an international terrorist. It's like, well, you know. And, you know, I mean, certainly Marvel G.I. Joe ended up with a lot of ninja stuff, you know, mystical and otherwise.
And also something about this plot that sort of felt a bit weird was that there was the whole deal about Master and Apprentice series 2, which the Satin plot point is built upon, and at the end of that, Storm Shadow was left as the in charge of the Red Ninja as the Phoenix Master, I believe they called him, and that isn't touched upon.
I think I imagine, since that was a miniseries, you know, your main comic always, you know, G.I. Joe always sells better than G.I. Joe Special Missions, right? Marvel 1986, 1987, 1988. A Devil's Due, G.I. Joe, America's Elite, or the end of, you know, the Brandon Jerwa Devil's Due is always going to sell better than a miniseries, because you have your regular readers and a store that, like, always knows to buy a few or a lot of the regular book might look at the annual, the special, the miniseries and say, well, this doesn't seem essential, or, oh, you know, we have some subscribers here who like G.I. Joe. I know to get them the specials or some of the specials. But it's like, well, now there's four G.I. Joe comics to get this month, not one or anyway. So I can imagine between Master and Apprentice 2 being the end of a run, the end of an era, a miniseries, a sequel miniseries, I think to a lesser or greater extent, Casey and the editor and Blaylock actively or passively said, we're not going to worry about that too much.
but then, you know, they did pick up on a major plot point, which was Satan, you know, being comatose after being, you know, beset by arrows.
That's true.
That's the reason that he's there, and that's the reason that, you know, Nunchuck was set up as the sort of the caretaker, sort of leader in Storm Shadow's absence.
Okay, so this, in the second half of issue 10, this is where Snake Eyes in Red is revealed on this only okay final splash page. Well, man, what a compositional choice to have a person bisecting his knee on the right side and to have his left index finger touching but not touching that sword. Anyway.
Well, on the page beforehand, there's a guy, this CIA agent, who's getting stuck with a sword from behind. I bet you, Tim, that that was originally drawn with the sword coming through and it was edited down to make it less gory.
Yes, it's possible it was edited. This is just a guess based on other comics we've read where people get impaled. But the sort of middle version is the sword is impaling the body, but not the shirt. Mm-hmm. And so you have this triangle of shirt sticking forward. So you know what's happening, but you don't actually see. Yeah.
And there's a little hint at that, just like the tension lines coming out from the center of the shirt. But yeah, not too much of a poke out.
So help me understand this, because in 12, Shebang, who's really Satan, says something like, we fight G.I. Joe, we fight Cobra. He's like, we don't need any of you. It's like, we're going our own way, or we're taking down all of our
Yeah, that sounds familiar. I mean, his motivations seemed a little bit muddied, and to be honest, I wasn't massively interested in them. I was like, yeah, okay, fine, you're a baddie, you're gonna do bad things, and let's get on with it.
Okay, so help me out with these final few pages in issue 10. So we cut to Kazakhstan, and there's this guy lighting a cigarette, and the other guy says, and this was meant to damage the main refinery. He says, suicide bombers. Okay. Is that fair to say Ferris? All right, so here's a CIA guy who's taken down a terrorist or a terrorist cell, right?
Yep.
And then the Red Ninjas show up and take them all out. And on the second to last page, he says, orphaned and asked, operation's been compromised. And then he's killed, and it's Snake Eyes. And so you're supposed to think, oh no, Snake Eyes is taking out a CIA contractor. It's like, no, Snake Eyes, that you should be stopping. But like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, is not, you know, it doesn't always have to be Joes or Cobras. Like, you know, I would sort of be upset if Snake Eyes were killing some Joe reservists, or if there was, but I get to this scene and I'm like, okay, well, Blood talked about killing someone. Is this guy? Do we have a name for this guy? The guy who gets killed?
Possibly. Maybe it's mentioned in the next issue or whatever, but yeah, he's dead. Doesn't matter.
So,
but it's used as a pretext that the Joes aren't allowed to sort of try and track down Snake Eyes, but because this CIA agent was killed in Mongolia, they're legitimized in going over to investigate what is happening there. So it sort of like ties in with what they wanted to do anyway.
All right. So I like that. And, you know, thinking back to issues of Special Missions or Marvel 92, you know, you sometimes get someone working with the Joes who's not a specific, he's not a G.I. Joe character, and he's not some army guy. It's like, no, he's a local guy, or he's a CIA guy. Maybe, I don't remember, maybe in, is it Special Missions 22 with the home hostage scene? Maybe it's a like FBI guy. So it's not always like other marquee G.I. Joe characters. So I think there's a place for this kind of scene, this kind of character. But it's like, I got a little confused because it's like, should I know who this is? Because there's been a little bit in the last year of Devil's Due. This what's Budo's name? Kyle?
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's been a little bit of names being used in a new or casual way. Like in these four issues we're reading, is it Roblox called Stalker Stalk? Like, that's okay. You know, like no one calls Roadblock Road. And something that I didn't like about the Chuck Dixon run at the beginning of IDW was like all these two syllable code names started getting cut in half. Like people would call Shipwreck Ship. And like, I do that. I have, you know, friends with, you know, like a name like Jonathan, you call someone John or Johnny or Jay or, but I, you know, it's like, like Jubilee can call Wolverine Wolvie, but no one else can. And, you know, Jean and Xavier can call him Logan, and, you know, like Storm and Cyclops, when they're having hearts to heart with him, can also call him Logan. Basically, everyone else should call him Wolverine. So I sort of thought, like, should I know who this guy is that Snake Eyes is about to kill, that Snake Eyes ends up killing? Should I know who these guys are? And then in issue 12, did you catch this? On page 13, this is under the panel where Kamakura is silhouette up in the rafters, and we're looking down at the Joe prisoners being escorted by a Red Ninja. Kamakura jumps down, and there's a Red Ninja, and he goes, "What? Master, the others are upon us!" And Kamakura says, "You have shamed yourself, Joshua! You are blinded to the truth!" And then Chabang, who's really Satan, says, "Blasphemy! I will not tolerate more betrayal! Eliminate him!" And then Stalker points a gun in his face, and I thought, that's cool. And I thought, wait, who's Joshua? And I thought, oh, I think it's this Red Ninja who... Yeah. Have we met Joshua?
I'm not sure. I mean, the Red Ninjas are sort of given names throughout these,
like Masaki.
Yeah, throughout the throughout
and, like, these. You know, it doesn't have to be a Japanese name, and people from Japan can be named Joshua. Like,
yeah,
that's
so
fine.
It's a reminder that these are all individuals, and the other ninjas have spent time with them. So again, at the back end of Master and Apprentice 2, they spent some time with them. So I guess the implication is that, you know, these aren't just faceless baddie red ninjas. They are acquaintances of Storm Shadow and Snake Eyes and Kamakura, because they have spent time with them before, and it's not that they're, you know, out and out bad. They sort of drop hints that you know, they're not out and out bad. It's just that they're being led in the wrong direction by Satan.
But it's weird.
Yeah.
Like, who's this guy? Why are you using a name now? And if the first time someone is introduced, if someone is wearing a mask and so are other characters in the scene, even if some ground has been laid that they are individuals and they have names, but it's all these guys in red masks. And I think I need Joshua to get mentioned, or I need a scene earlier on where Chabang, who's really Satan, you know, it's like, Joshua, bring me my sword. We'll be walking down the hallway, or bring me the prisoners, or, you know, whatever it is. Now, that said, this final issue, which has 6 extra pages, the cover tells me, the art by Juan Baramko is really nice.
I was going to say, sort of looking at the different issues, this one stands out as looking particularly nice, at least in the pencils and inks. Less impressed by the colors on this. I don't think the colors are very good. They're sort of,
The colors are really aggressive in a modern way, and I don't love it, but they are better done than the other colors in these couple of issues that are colored in a modern way. And part of it is that there are more hard edges for highlights, and I think it also helps that the art is so good. But
it looks a lot to me like early Brian Hitch.
It's got
a nice sort of it's got a lived-in sort of grimy feel to it as well.
Baramko is doing a lot of detail in anatomy and facial anatomy. He is very comfortable drawing faces and the human figure in a realistic, naturalistic way, right? Whereas Nelson Blake II is simplifying and flattening things a little bit. Like, look at page 11. Look at page 11, the bottom panel where Kamakura is holding up his hands to do the ninja hex. It's really subtle, but the way his head is tipped forward and how well those hands are drawn, that is some drawing chops. And the artist who I was thinking of, this reminds me of, now that you say Hitch, yes, I think I see some similarity to Hitch. I was thinking of Oscar Jimenez, who drew some issues of The Flash for DC a few years, 5 years before this, and was too slow and couldn't hang on to that book. And then later on did some stuff for Wildstorm. Roadblock and Stalker and Flint and Scarlet, they have different faces. You know, it's not like stock comic book faces, which is okay. Like, you're allowed to do that. And I like plenty of artists who do that, but it's always exciting when someone can go a step further and draw different noses, different lips, different, you know, cheekbones, not just like, you know, this guy has a mustache, this guy doesn't. And Baramko's art adds some nice flair and pep to the Duke showdown with the Crimson Guardsman.
Nice sort of silhouetted panel as he sort of sticks him with that.
So in one issue you can impale someone, and in another issue in this arc you can't.
Silhouette, perhaps.
In terms of story, in this In issue 11, there's this scene where, so the Joe's helicopter crashes into the Red Ninja's base, and then they all start fighting, and then a Red Ninja, and I think it's Chabang, who's really Satin. And by the way, I think this is a missed opportunity, because Chabang or Satin are individual characters. Even if he's wearing a Red Ninja costume,
yeah,
he needs something, and maybe it's just the gloves, but he needs something much more that really separates him, his costume. He needs like shoulder pads and like polka dots or something, right? If not like a red version of Chabang's G.I. Joe Ninja Force costume. Or Satan even has a data disc. Anyway, so it's less fun, and it's a little harder to follow this when the one guy who is a very specific Red Ninja looks exactly like the other Red Ninjas. So yeah. Anyway, here a few pages into issue 11, a Red Ninja, I think it's Chabang as Satan, throws a grenade at three of the Joes. And because I think Nelson Blake II is a little bit rushing this scene, and I'm convinced that these pages are still him and that Pat Quinn comes on later in the issue. So two things that I think are silly. One, I feel like you don't throw a grenade when you're in the same room with someone. And two, I guess it's three things. Two, because Nelson Blake II isn't really drawing backgrounds during this fight, I lose a sense of how big the room is, which adds to my sort of puzzled feeling about the grenade. Like, okay, I see from the throwing pose, I think he's throwing the grenade far, but when the grenade explodes, I don't know where any of the Red Ninjas are. And it feels like, wait, aren't you awfully close to that? Wouldn't some of the shrapnel maybe hit you? Or if the floor is going to crack and people are going to fall in, aren't you and your guys at risk of falling in too? It's like, well, if the backgrounds had been drawn more concretely, and I knew where everyone is in relationship to a wall or the doorway or the throne. Okay, so
yeah, it's, I think it, well, I was interpreting that as them being outside the Mongolian structure.
Outside the what?
Outside the, like, the temple building. So they're not yet inside, but you know, might not be the case, but that sequence, you know, did strike me as looking a bit odd, that, you know, a grenade goes off, it causes explosions.
A few pages earlier, where the helicopter is sticking outside, everything is dark blue and nighttime. And where the helicopter is sticking inside, everything is orange and inside.
Okay, got you. Okay, yeah, I misread that then. But as you said, it's like a massive open space with no detailing to indicate that there's any walls or anything anywhere nearby. So yeah. And then the hole opens up, and then there's this underground cavern thing that just sort of happens to be there. So, it's a bit right. Okay.
So I don't want to do this thing where, like, if something is quote cartoony, if something reminds you of an animated cartoon, it is simple or dumb or unintelligent, and things that aren't cartoony, like animated television, are like more sophisticated. But this scene reminds me of the G.I. Joe TV cartoon in a way that it doesn't remind me of the G.I. Joe comic, because it's really convenient that the Joes fall. They fall far enough to knock themselves out, but not to really get hurt. But then Chabang, who's really Satin, doesn't immediately go after them. He says, Masaki, Kaihu, never mind them. We still have enemies here to deal with. Again, this might be Nelson Blake II might be sort of contending with how much space he has to draw the things that Casey's asking of him and how much time he has to draw them in. But three Joes fall.
Four Joes captured.
And maybe the problem is I'm not sure actually how many Red Ninja come in to do this fight and how many get taken out by, you know, kicking and punching and shooting. And so maybe this dialogue is exactly the explanation that I'm looking for. But it kind of seems like what the scene wants is Chabang, who's really a Satin, to say, Masaki, go down there and capture those three. Kaihu, come with me and help finish off these other four. Because it just seems convenient that it's like, well, you know, I'm sure they're in the catacombs and unconscious. I measured the height.
Yeah. Let's not worry about those ones.
Then a few pages later, it seems important that they go get those guys. And then it's those guys that sort of break them out. So I understand the sort of mechanics of it. It's like, no, you have to separate them so someone can rescue someone later. But I feel like there's a little bit of story logic or a little bit of explanatory dialogue missing there.
I was going to say the change of art in this issue, I think, is fairly apparent. It's sort of towards the back of the book where they transition to the rock. There's a scene with Spark and Sparks. And...
Yes, correct. Nelson stops drawing when Scarlet says, "Come back to me," and Satin Tabang says, "So futile," and then we cut back to the rock. And then it's the Joes climbing the stalactites. That is now the change in art. All right, speaking of something missing, in issue 12 on page 17, we've cut to the Amazon jungle and Duke is sneaking up behind a bat. And then the Crimson Guardsman has a question mark and an exclamation mark and says, "What was?" And then Duke, holding some wires and a sharp thing, says, "You and I have unfinished business, Colonel." And to me, this is a missing sound effect. Mm. Because in the first panel, it's meant to be quiet. Duke is tiptoeing, he's creeping, and he's gonna take out this bat. And then in the second panel, the Colonel hears something.
Yep.
But I don't really know that he hears something because his dialogue is sort of vague. But I think there needs to be like a sound effect behind him that's like clang or clunk,
yep.
And then, or tear. And then in the next panel, it's like, okay, Duke has just torn off the bat's arm and also deactivated the bat's head or something. And I actually count this as an error detected. I count this as a something that's missing that should have been there. And, you know, this is a comic that doesn't have a lot of sound effects, right? When swords are slashing and machine guns are firing in these fights, there isn't a lot of like swish, clang, blam, rat-a-tat-a-tat. But sometimes the absence of a sound effect reads as a mistake, not as a like a stylistic choice, because sound effects are like unsophisticated or look like kids' comics. And I disagree. Sound effects are a tool in your toolkit and you should use them. Mm.
Yeah, so I think let's start wrapping up. There's a little bit here and there. I think we've covered most of the story. They sort of get there and they wrap things up and they almost sort of self-referentially say, "Well, there's a lot of ninja stuff going on there." Colton says, "So anyone want to venture a guess how they did it? You want to explain?" And then Shipwreck says, "You want me to explain ninja voodoo? No thanks." So it's like, okay, let's sort of draw this to a conclusion and move on from it. Flint sets himself as being inactive, so finally, you know, making a realization that maybe he should move on, not in the best place. And then we have the Cobra Commander reveal, setting up the grand issue 13.
Let me point out a couple last interesting things. So the inside back cover of issue 11 is a one page house ad for Devil's Due, which is all black and white and red with some white and yellow type. And it's this offer where if you tear a cover off of a Marvel or DC book and mail it to Devil's Due, they will mail you a whole Devil's Due comic. And it's Devil's Due's ripped off offer, because maybe you've read some bad comics and you're disappointed, and we'll send you some good comics. And at the bottom it says, "The comic covers sent in must have been released in the last 2 months. Covers must be from, quote, the Big Two. If you don't know what that means, we're not going to tell you. Devil's Due may send you any Devil's Due comic book with no guarantee, but let us know your preferences." And this, and also on the opposing page, there's a full page ad for this Josh Blaylock helping hand contest, right? Which gets a full page ad in, I think, also issue 12, and also makes it to the Devil's Due news page, where One lucky winner and two lucky runners-up will get various amounts of phone call and email back and forth with Josh Blaylock to self-publish their comics. Not Devil's Due is not going to do it for you, but consulting from Josh Blaylock, who self-published a lot of books before he started Devil's Due. And while these issues are being published, Devil's Due is publishing a four-issue miniseries about how to self-publish comics, not just make them, and written and drawn by Josh Blaylock. And I like this contest and this other offer because it's a reminder of how plucky Devil's Due is. Company's only five and a half years old, and they are very much trying to connect with readers. And, you know, you and I haven't talked about the message boards in this episode, but those are still going. And even though, you know, our focus with Devil's Due is like the G.I. Joe license and all the good and challenge that comes from that, here is still this small but growing company that wants to sort of pull a stunt or two to get some attention, but also legitimately pull in readers and create a conversation. You know, this feels very much like something that Wizard Magazine might cover, you know, like, check out Devil's Due ripped offer. Like, man, those guys are taking DC and Marvel down a peg. And then I have an error detected, which is twice in issues 11 and 12. There is a full page ad for Scarlet Declassified, and it shows Phil Noto's cover, and it's got a bunch of type on it. And the type all looks fine, but the image itself is printed at 72 DPI, and it looks really crummy. You have to find a diagonal. It's really, so look at her shoulder and look at the like squares on the sort of her shoulder pad. And you can see like fuzzy, like steps, you know, like when you make a diagonal line, when you draw a diagonal line in a computer and it's low resolution, you see like JPEG, like squares, you see steps, not a smooth diagonal line, not a smooth curve. And you can see some JPEG compression in Scarlett's eyes and like on her nose, where the color is, for lack of a better word, fuzzy. And this is one of those printing things where like how you output layers from Photoshop as PDFs. It's like, I can't finish this sentence, but there's a way to do it, and there are ways to get it wrong. Can I do one last error detected? In issue 12 on page 9, Stalker picks up and is supporting Kamakura with his left arm. He's wrapping Kamakura's left arm like around his shoulder. And that's where Kamakura just got stabbed. So Stalker, support Kamakura on Kamakura's right side, not his left side.
Poor Kamakura. I had an error detected, which was in number 9. There's a sailor which is blocking the way to the submarine where Scarlet is trying to get onto there to get access to the more powerful computer, and he says that he can't let her in, and his instructions are implicit, which means that they're implied, so not very clear instructions, whereas I think he should be saying my instructions are explicit, where it's been made clear to him that he is not.
And then Scarlet says, Sailor, I just punched a computer screen with my fist.
Yeah.
My cat wants to get out.
I think we're almost done. So for my I Spy, I think we've covered them actually as we've gone along. I just had an additional question for you, Tim, which was the New Orleans Collectors Con. This is now, 2006? Yes.
Yeah.
2006. In New Orleans. Were you there?
No, I didn't go to my first. I went to one JoeCon in Providence and then didn't start going regularly until like 13 or 14.
Okay. And this had this particular convention, Heroes Unite in New Orleans, had an exclusive Cobra's Most Wanted Mercenaries box set.
Postbox Pit. This is where you can send in your thoughts. Mark and Tim will hear it, and then we'll discuss it. It's really nice to hear from our biggest fans.
Let's listen to what Rusty sent us in with his thoughts on these particular issues.
Hey, Mark. This is Rusty from San Francisco. I'm really having a good time doing a read-along with you and Tim of America's Elite, and I'm up to issue 12 now. Despite my enjoyment, there's some criticisms I have. I am not a fan of Magic Ninja Snake Eyes, and I wish we could get a Commando Snake Eyes with maybe a sprinkling of ninja. I'm also surprised that we were doing the same sort of ninja magic stuff basically 20 years ago that I haven't been a fan of recently. On the more positive side, I was excited to see our Crimson Guardsmen who took Duke hostage. Growing up, I got a hold of the Action Force Monthly comic, and I loved the way Marvel UK portrayed the Crimson Guard. And so that's always just a neat spot for me. Again, I wish that plot thread would have gone a little more, or maybe we could have seen a bit more of that Crimson Guardsman. Also, I loved seeing Major Blood again. I don't know why, but he's a great character for me, and I feel like I get the most enjoyment just out of his background on the file card and leaving it to my own imagination. But I'm really intrigued by this missing slash killed Joe. I'll sign off for now, but I'll just say before I go, nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast.
That's great, Rusty. Thank you. I will sideways agree with something you're kind of saying, which is there's never been enough Major Blood in G.I. Joe. He can show up in more episodes. He can show up in more issues.
And I think Rusty is going to be in for a treat, because I think in going forward, we will see less Magic Ninja Snake Eyes and more Commando Snake Eyes. So that's a little feeling I've got.
All right, so the sort of note I want to end on is that in the letters page of issue 11, sorry, type is so hard to read. In the letters page of issue 11, this is sort of something that you and I might think about for our next episode as we start to wrap up the Joe Casey run. Ian Z. Latchett says, smaller cast has kept me from seeing some of my old favorites, but I love, but I've made new favorites. The focus being on the characters as people within the stories instead of just action figures has really helped. I attribute this in no small part to Joe Casey, whose work I have followed for years. This has to be the most un-Casey-like book in style I've ever seen, but still overflowing with that same Casey quality. The abandoned Crimson Guard soldier felt like a Casey character, and to me, it really shows how comfortable Casey has gotten with G.I. Joe, and made me realize how much I'm actually liking this book. So I thought that's really interesting, because in our first episode about America's Elite, I spent a lot of time talking about how much of a fan I was of Casey's work before this, and how excited I was to see him take on G.I. Joe, and I'm also sort of cautious, because anyone who's not that guy who's written the most G.I. Joe comics, I sort of wonder, are they up to the task? But I found this a really interesting comment that this G.I. Joe is so un-Casey-like, and I think I need to think about sort of what that means. I haven't reread a lot of Joe Casey comics recently, but you know, what about this is different or similar to, you know, Wildcats or his Uncanny X-Men? And maybe this is a question for Joe Casey, if we can ever get questions to him. You know, do you consider your G.I. Joe sort of to be of a piece with your other writing, or besides in the obvious ways, unlike your other writing?
Yeah, interesting. So to sum up for me and give it a Yo-Joe scoreage, I think I'm going to go in with a 6. Not a regrettable reads. There are definitely components of this that I enjoyed. I thought the art in issue 12 was particularly strong, although I didn't enjoy the colouring of it. But overall, the art as an arc was, you know, a little bit inconsistent. less of a fan of Magic Ninja Snake Eyes and co, but yeah, certainly still bits within it to enjoy, and by no means a regrettable read. And we're left on an intriguing plot point about Cobra Commander in the White House. Tim?
I will give it a 5. It's okay. It's okay.
Okay. So next time on Talking Joe Disavowed, we will continue our look at the America's elite era of G.I. Joe with Special Missions Tokyo, followed up by The Hunt for Cobra Commander one-shot 25 cents special and issue 13. And we'll have other things going on in between as well, I'm sure. So, Tim, where can people find you when you are not talking to me about G.I. Joe comics?
Video essays from my creative partners and I at our YouTube channel, Atomic Abe Productions. My brick-and-mortar comic book store in Somerville, Massachusetts is Hub Comics. And I write about G.I. Joe at arealamericanbook.com.
Excellent stuff. You can find more about Talking Joe at the usual places. TalkingJoe.co.uk is the website that has links to all of those places. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. We are also on Patreon at patreon.com/TalkingJoe. So a big thanks to all our backers: Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, and Shane, who are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. And that is us done for now. But remember that
nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast.
Laters.